Thanks a lot for the invitation. I'm of course very glad to share with you our recent work that has been done with Markus Schmidt while we were still postdocs at Berkeley before both moving back to Europe. And if time allows, I might touch or add another story that's partially related. So the main question that I'll address or that we'll be discussing during this talk will be whether it's possible to detect simple physical descriptions in otherwise complex and complicated quantum states. And to do so, we will somehow go beyond or will not use the standard quantum info approaches, but will instead propose a new let's say measure of local complexity that utilizes unsupervised learning to detect this complexity. And so what do I mean by this local complexity is kind of pretty simple. It's, so whatever can be detected with some local observables, with some local measurements, and can be in a sense as simple as the number of parameters that we need to reproduce all local observables up to some support. And as Tim mentioned, I somehow come more from this non-equilibrium community, so most of the applications of this approach will be targeted at a non-equilibrium. So we'll, for example, use it to detect different stages of non-equilibrium dynamics, to tell whether the Hamiltonian is thermalizing or not, also to learn what is the Hamiltonian that we are looking at the observables coming from it. And since it's very experimentally friendly, it's essentially really based, it only utilizes local observables, we believe it could be a useful tool to analyze results from quantum simulators, but also to characterize these, them because, as I'll show, it can also be used to detect the noise that might be polluting those simulators. Okay, so that's kind of the plan. And to be a bit more concrete, one setup that we will look at from different angles and whose complexity we'll try to characterize will be the following. So imagine that I start my system in a simple product state, which is of course a very simple state. And then I run some time evolution with a Hamiltonian that is interacting and tangling. Of course, what will happen is that the complexity of the state will grow and the correlations will spread. So under such a time evolution, eventually the system will get so scrambled that if we look at it on some local scale, if we measure some local expectation values, those will be essentially governed by some emergent hydrodynamic description. And in this sense, the complexity of the system, at least on these local time scales, local scales at long time scales will decrease. And eventually for this description, one only needs conservation loss to the point where it's somehow infinite times so in the steady states, where the situation is even simpler and one can use simply just statistical descriptions. Because what we've learned in those years is that if I measure some local spins, the rest of the system at long times acts as a buff. So if I have a chaotic system, I'll simply measure thermal expectation values. And this is again extremely simple because it's only characterized with a single parameter and this is temperature. Now, when we think of which quantities could detect such an information bottleneck from what we are kind of what we usually use. The entanglement entropy of states will not do it because it will always just grow with time. Then it turns out that there is, so if we instead look at the operator entanglement entropy for a vectorized density matrix, and for example, if we calculate it for some reduced density matrices, this will essentially have this bottleneck structure because the operator entanglement entropy will be small for the initial product state, and it will also be small for the thermal steady state. And in the middle, it will have somehow a bottleneck that depends on the length of this reduced density matrix. But in some sense, it will also be there by construction, to say so. And now we wanted to go one step further and ask, like, is there another way how to, in a sense, compress the quantum evolution and really detect kind of the physically relevant decrease of freedom? So somehow, if we are after sort of compression of quantum evolution, we decided to use autoencoders, which are, really typically also outside of physics, used for compression. So what does an autoencoder do? So it takes some data, and then it tries to reconstruct it by going through a bottleneck. And such a neural network architecture that tries to accomplish this task. And of course, the idea is that the bottleneck has a smaller dimension than it is the dimension of the data. In this case, the compression is possible. So in our case, the data will be just expectation values of local operators. So we will consider spin systems. So this will be just strings of Pauli operators up to some given support, let's say 3 or 4 sites. So each data set will contain expectation values of, let's say, NO of such local operators. But then to do training and learning, we'll need many of such sets, as we'll discuss on each example later. And as I've already said, that in our case, we'll look for the dimensional reduction from this NO, so from the expectation values, which are, let's say, 100 of them, down to some smaller NL dimensional latent space. And what we do is that in the first step, we initialize our network by optimizing this reproduced data with respect to the original one by going through this bottleneck. And then in the second step, we test it by showing it some unseen expectation values and see again what is this, so how big is this difference, so what's the kind of what will cause the test error by going through this bottleneck. So that's kind of on the technical part. Now kind of back to physics, we will start here with the simplest regime, and we'll first try to test this approach here, let's say in this regime of steady states, when, as I said, we know that when I look at some local expectation values, these look as if I'm coming from a thermal ensemble. If I have a chaotic system, Now, if I would do a time evolution with some integrable system with macroscopically many conservation laws, then the correct ensemble is actually the so-called generalized Gibbs ensemble, which contains additional parameters associated with the additional conservation laws. So the first task will be very simple. We'll just test whether these autoencoders can detect that our data is coming from, let's say, a thermal ensemble or a generalized Gibbs ensemble. And we'll try to determine the number of parameters that our data is parametrized with. To do so, we'll actually use an integrable Hamiltonian, just the I guess, the simplest one, the transverse easing. And then in this first step, we'll really just have a synthetic data. So our expectation values will be calculated with respect to now a generalized Gibbs ensemble, but with a fixed number of Lagrange parameters, those kind of so-called generalized temperatures, that will be just drawn randomly. So we'll not really do a time evolution. We'll just, in this first step, we just want to test our approach. So really we draw different ensembles with a fixed number of included conservation laws and then randomly draw these Lagrange multipliers. And of course, what we have to obtain is that this test error, so how well we reproduce the data by going through the bottleneck, that it drops when this dimension of the bottleneck and L equals the number of parameters that are really parameterizing this data. And that's indeed what we see here. So we see that this test error drops when the number of neurons in the bottleneck equals the number of conservation laws spanning the generalized Gibbs ensemble. So that is good news. So it means that, okay, our autoencoder is indeed detecting the correct number of parameters that are characterizing our data. Now, we can kind of try to understand it, what's happening a little bit better. So for example, let's focus on the simplest case, that is on the thermal ensembles, and try to understand a bit better what is learned. So of course, we physically know that what is parameterizing the Gibbs ensemble is temperature. So what we've seen now is that indeed, if we know what is, and we know that if you know what's the temperature, we can calculate arbitrary correlation function or expectation value of the operator we are interested in. And also on the previous slide, we've seen that indeed, if we are dealing with thermal data sets, we need just a single neuron in the bottleneck. Now we can ask what is learned on this neuron. And is it a temperature? Is it an energy density? That would be maybe a physical guesses, but it turns out that it's just an invertible function of energy or temperature, but that's of course just a legitimate answer from our network. So that's good and sensible. Now, when we also, another way of seeing it that we'll also utilize later is that maybe we can use, so we can allow for a larger latent space and then project it to two dimensions and see how does the network see our data. So we give it some data set, and what it does for each data set, it will map it to one, essentially one point in 2D. So So each data set will be like one point here on this plot. Okay, for specialists, what we do, we do a SNE projector or projection of the latent space, but if you don't want it to be so technical, you can just imagine as if we would allow for two neurons in the latent space and then see how each data set is mapped into this two-dimensional space. And it's kind of, I mean, how it should be, but it's nice to see that the neural network really, or that the all these data sets are ordered in a one-dimensional manifold shown here, because as we've known, this is in agreement with the fact that we only need one parameter, that is the temperature, to describe them. And of course, not only do the points lie on this one-dimensional manifold, they are also ordered with respect to energy. So what the colors on this plot here are the energy densities of each data set containing all expectation values with some given energy density. And now we can use this, for example, for the reconstruction of Hamiltonian, because we know that not only the energy is monotonously varying along this manifold, but also expectation values of any terms in the Hamiltonian will do so. And that information, with this information, we can now check, so which operators have the largest average gradient along this manifold in this TSNE projection. And what we get that for the transverse easing Hamiltonian, really the terms that have the largest gradient are ZZ and sigma X operators. We also get that some products of those operators could be false candidate terms for the Hamiltonian. So one needs to do another step, and we just did Newton's method, which then really sets the correct coefficients in the Hamiltonian by comparing kind of this candidate Hamiltonian thermal ensembles with the measured one, and in this sense fix the weight, the coefficients in the Hamiltonian. So let me repeat. So one application of this approach is that if you're given some data, which first turns out to be thermal, which one can check by just really checking that just a single parameter describes it, and then by looking at for this candidate terms and doing this Newton's method, one can reconstruct the Hamiltonian from the observables. Then if the data is already, so now let's say if the data was originating from a generalized Gibbs ensemble with two parameters, then what we observe again in this TSNE projection, so we again kind of project this latent space to 2D, and we see that correctly one dimension is spanned by the Hamiltonian, while the perpendicular direction is spanned by the second conservation law in the GGE. So this tells us that indeed the autoencoder recognizes the correct directions that are spanning the ensemble describing our data. And so So for as a partial summary, this now allows us, for example, to distinguish chaotic from integrable models and also to reconstruct the Hamiltonians from the data. And now, since we kind of checked it on the simplest, in the simplest limit, we can also be a bit more ambitious and try to detect this bottleneck in a general dynamics. So to do so, we actually looked at the time evolution with some random unitaries with magnetization conservation. So we don't have, in this case, we don't have energy conservation, but we have a single conservation law, and that is energy. So we expect that that long times system will be described by one parameter, and that is chemical potential. We initialize it in a product state and then run this time evolution and measure a local observations at each time step. And somehow, as expected, what we get is that, yeah, so what I'm showing here is again the so the color is the test error, so how well the data is reproduced by going through the bottleneck as a function of time and number of neurons in the bottleneck. And we see that indeed at initial state, we need two parameters to describe the state. At long times, we need just one parameter, and that is chemical potential, to describe it. And then in between, the network detects kind of this growth of complexity, and then essentially the onset of hydro regime at longer times. That's already quite nice, but of course, that's just the first step. So, it would be much nicer if we could also kind of learn really what these emergent hydrodynamic equations of motion, or even kind of, so that's still, to do this, we need an input that's kind of data coming from some other calculation from a simulator that performs this time evolution. And of course, the next step would be to learn essentially how to throw away the information such that the actual calculation leading to the hydrodynamic regimes and starting from the initial state would be possible. So essentially going for a compressed type of quantum simulation that somehow throws away what is not necessary to describe, for example, long times. But maybe this is not possible because this bottleneck is always kind of exponentially high. And that's, I guess, is one active research direction.
So can I ask a question?
Sure.
So the number of variables you need and L for the bottleneck, in the maximum number of variables that you need, how does that scale with a region, local region that you choose to reproduce?
Here I'm always plotting. So I think, here we just chose three sites. And I would expect that, in the beginning I was showing the results from operator entanglement entropy, where they were literally changing here the size of this reduced density matrix for which they calculated the operator entanglement entropy. Mm-hmm. So, and they saw that that this bottleneck was growing as you looked at a larger reduced density matrix. And essentially for this quantity, from this analysis, you could see that the bond dimension you need for your density matrix or for your MPO is growing exponentially with the size. Now, so that's kind of the knowledge from this paper that I have. Here, we didn't do a comparable analysis, but I sort of also expect that we would detect something like this. I could make another comment, and that was that, for example, here when we were looking, so it's partially related. For example, here when we were looking at these generalized Gibbs ensembles, with including more and more conservation laws, where the third one is actually a three-site operator, there you also see that you needed to include, first of all, you need your bottleneck to be at least dimension three to detect this GG with three parameters, but also you need support of at least, if you include this step becomes more clear when you actually have operators that are somehow susceptible to disinformation from the third conservation law.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, good. So that's kind of okay. I've covered now, let's say, the part on the detection of the complexity from measurements. And now in this second section, I'd like to touch a bit like what if there's some weak noise or weak coupling to the bots, because that's kind of the topic that I've been interested in recently. So suppose that you have an evolution with Hamiltonian, but then you also have coupling to say Markovian bots, which might be weak or strong. We'll first discuss the case when this coupling is weak. And somehow we've already, in our previous works, we've already theoretically discussed this limit when the coupling to bots is very weak or formally infinitesimal. And we've shown that still, if you have chaotic Hamiltonian, your system will relax to a Gibbs ensemble, while if you have an integrable Hamiltonian, it will still relax to a generalized Gibbs ensemble. That might be a bit of surprise, or at least when we looked at this, because integrability is typically considered to be extremely fragile, and we tend to believe that whatever coupling to bots or integrability breakings we introduce to the system will always thermalize. While here in our works, we actually showed that there is a very, that indeed the system will thermalize when you add static integrability breaking terms. So how we usually picture it that, okay, you would start from some initial state, but then you would, and pretty quickly you will kind of pre-thermalize to some sort of generalized Gibbs ensemble, because on short time scale, your system doesn't know of the presence of some integrability breaking. But then eventually, as it starts to realize it's not exactly thermal, exactly integrable, it will eventually thermalize. So here I'm kind of plotting as if I have some GG manifold, and that would be a manifold of thermal state. So in the presence of a static integrability breaking, the system would thermalize. And what we showed in our work was that if you add some weak driving and with weak openness, this will essentially compensate other integrability breaking terms, and your system will essentially, yeah, it will also pre-thermalize, but then it will evolve along such a generalized Gibbs ensemble manifold and relax to a fixed point GG, which is determined by the coupling to the environment. So even if you start from some other initial states, you would also relax to the same GG, which is nice. So kind of by your coupling to the environment, you can kind of even engineer the states or the GGs to which you relax. And now, I mean, we can somehow, yeah, now we can, and there's not really been an experiment confirming this, but we could also now utilize these autoencoders to confirm this in a rather easy way. So, and that's maybe I'd like to flesh out here and give some more comments. So I should also say that, I mean, if you have a finite coupling to the environment, there will be some corrections on top of this generalized Gibbs ensemble relaxation that I described. And that, let's see how this physics is seen by autoencoder. So to do so, we will consider many, so our data sets will be many steady states coming from a randomly rotated single and two site Lindblad operators. So we, that are written here, but doesn't matter. So for let's say 200 different rotations of this single and two site Lindblad operators, we calculate the steady state. And then we give this to autoencoder to somehow detect and essentially, to detect the complexity of this ensemble of data. And what we sort of expect is that for chaotic Hamiltonian, we will relax to a thermal state, and for integrable to a generalized Gibbs ensemble to confirm what I mentioned previously. And indeed, when we look again at this test error by going through this bottleneck of autoencoder as a function of the dimension of the bottleneck, we see that a pretty good reconstruction is for a chaotic Hamiltonian obtained already with a single latent variable, which again turns out to be related to energy. And then there is some more improvement, which is related to these corrections and due to the finite coupling to the bath. While when we have an integrable Hamiltonian, we need at least two latent variables to get kind of a comparably good reconstruction, and then some additional variables still improve the core structure and were probably related to noise and even additional conservation loss. So we certainly need more conservation, more latent variables for this additional conservation loss.
And also, can I ask a question?
Sure.
I just wanted to know if this was also, these results are also done for three sites?
These are now for four.
Four site Hamiltonian? Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
No, yeah, four site observable. So all observables up to four sites, yes.
Sorry, got it.
Yeah. Yes. And now, once again, when we kind of try to visualize how this latent, so how the data is seen in the latent space, it's kind of nice that for the chaotic Hamiltonian, it's roughly one-dimensional with this primary dimension again spanned by the Hamiltonian, while when we have an integrable Hamiltonian, at least, okay, now when projected into 2D, it looks more 2D-ish, and the kind of this two, the one, one direction is spanned by the Hamiltonian, and the second one is apparently spanned by some linear combination of the most local parity even conservation loss. So, I mean, okay, for people, so here we, so one thing is, okay, nice. We see that indeed there is a difference between chaotic and integrable systems. And what's kind of the added value is that even though integrable systems have in principle macroscopically many conservation laws, and this sum here is horrible, we see that for, let's say, operators up to four sites, we know that only the most local, essentially the two most local parity even conservation laws are the important ones. And by kind of by doing these visualizations, we can even infer which conservation laws are really important for the given setup. So we can kind of reduce, using autoencoders, we can kind of reduce this vast dimensional space of integral. I mean, we can reduce the number of conservation laws that are really important to describe the integrable models and not live with macroscopically many that are there in principle. And this might also be a fruitful way to think of some reduced descriptions of integrable models. And also the Hamiltonian reconstruction works up to some error also in this noisy case. But I mean, here for the chaotic Hamiltonian, one could ask what is spanning the perpendicular direction. And to make it more clear, we instead considered coupling to baths, so Lindblad operators that are favoring some correlation functions. For example, here, I take, like I flip a spin on site I up if my neighbor is down. So it's clearly, and there have different symmetric versions of this. So this is something that's favoring an anti-pragmatic correlation. And what we can nicely see is that actually this perpendicular direction is spanned by the correlations that the noise or that the baths are promoting. So one direction is spanned by the Hamiltonian and the perpendicular one by the noise, which also could be or offers some possibility for noise type reconstruction, which could be the noise that is persistently in our simulator and could be detected by running many runs of the simulator and then just somehow statistically detecting it in this way. And as another thing that is now allowed or is possible with this approach, so also to ask, like, what about strong coupling to the environment? So people have oftentimes asked me, but is there some sort of an emergent thermal description with some emergent, maybe different Hamiltonian than my actual Hamiltonian at stronger couplings to baths? And now might be difficult to detect it if you have no clue what this H prime could be. And now one can use this kind of autoencoders and just simply see that if I take stronger coupling to baths, there's clearly more latent variables necessary. So this means that there is no kind of parameterization with a single emergent temperature. I think I'll skip this. So maybe I guess I'm, yeah. So at this point, I would draw some conclusions on this topic and take questions now. And maybe then we can decide if we add some more later, some more information later. So what I've kind of described in this first part is that by using autoencoders, we were at least able to detect the existence of low-dimensional representation in some quantum evolution. And these the applications of this approach being like distinguishing or detecting thermalization, so distinguishing chaotic from integrable systems, reconstruction of the Hamiltonians, and then also kind of detecting the complexity or in open systems and the potential for the reconstruction of the noise. So yeah, I know I'm a bit early, so but I think it's let's first take some questions if they are on this on this part, and maybe we can continue or not, depending on the number of questions.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Sure.
So you use this autoencoders, right? Like, if I understand correctly, they are non-linear autoencoders, right?
So they're neural nets. The transformations here are kind of are non-linear. Yes.
And so my question is, have you tried the linear autoencoders, which are kind of like equivalent to principal component analysis? And so you can interpret everything in terms of, say, singular value decompositions and so on. Like, have you tried to make the encoder linear to make the whole thing interpretable?
So the answer is no. Well, we didn't try.
Okay. Now, thanks.
So, like, if I think of mapping arbitrary expectation values to something like temperature, is of course a nonlinear function. Now, so could it? Let's say if we know that physically, I need to relate all these data to some. Let's say if I have just a thermal data sets to temperature or energy density. Is it possible? I mean, is it feasible with a linear?
Right, I see. I see what you mean. Okay, thank you.
Zala, I had a question about this noisy simulation. So there was a reference at the beginning that you mentioned that they found that for like dissipative dynamics, this complexity bottleneck behaves differently from the closed system dynamics.
So, you mean for the operator entanglement?
So they claimed that this peak in complexity scales as an area law as opposed to volume law.
That's right. So here they claim that this is essentially kind of cut off by your openness. So you would have growth, but like then if you're, yeah. So, but then that, yeah, essentially the openness kind of poses a cutoff to your at least this quantity, the operator entanglement.
I was wondering if you like observe that qualitatively when you were looking at your like number of latent variables in this case, or
we didn't do this particular study, and it's in a sense. Yeah, I think the interesting question is like, if you take something like negativity or our numbers, like do all of these quantifiers of complexity show sort of an area law or not? But we did not really do it. So that would be, in the sense of this kind of entanglement entropy type of phase transitions, yeah, and like another type of a quantifier of like, does it, if you think, I mean, if you have a density matrix of an open system, is it always kind of an area law, right? But maybe with a really big bond dimension or with, yeah.
Mm. Okay, thanks.
So, Zala, can we go to the slide where you show the flow of time-dependent state with noise, where?
But yeah, but this was without noise. You mean these random unitaries?
No. With a noise. You have some schematic diagram where.
Yeah. Right.
21. Yeah. So here, trying to understand. So, did you say that with noise, kind of the state flows to some fixed point that exhibit some extra conserved quantities? Is that the statement?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's kind of the point that's what we've, at least we gave numerical evidence for all of this in those papers here. Actually, there's another archive that I forgot to cite. But yeah, the point is that that really what we numerically observed is that if you take a chaotic system, you will go to a Gibbs state. But if you take an integrable system, maybe in the presence of some Hamiltonian integrability breaking, but if you on top add some weak driving and openness, which could be either Lindblads or it could be Bath's plus Floquet type of system, if this is weak, these expansion points of density matrix will be GGE. And then has some corrections. But somehow, if you take a limit of epsilon to zero, I mean, somehow, yeah, the expansion point of your even steady state, but also the time-dependent density matrix is a GGE. And I mean, as it's always the case, or almost always the case for open systems, I mean, of course, this fixed point is given by the Lindbladians, by the openness, because this is what determines the steady state. So in such a setup where you have an integrable Hamiltonian plus weak coupling to Bath's, indeed you will, you first pre-thermalize to some point, which is like a usual pre-thermal example given by the initial state. And then you have a deterministic evolution that is governed by the openness described by a time-dependent GGE that also then terminates in another GGE with Lagrange multipliers fixed by coupling by Lindblads.
So does the driving break the integrability, or
yes.
It breaks the integrability?
Yes.
I see. And here, do you take a large T limit first and small epsilon limit later, or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, okay, if you would formally, so in the limit, when you would take time to infinity and epsilon to zero, your steady state density matrix would be exactly a GGE. But it's time first and then epsilon to zero, because anyway, the other way around, it would be an integrable system. But in this case, it's kind of not, I mean, so that's the limit when the density matrix is really a GGE. Now, when you have, and this would be, yeah, and this would take infinitely long, but if you have a finite coupling to the environment, you still have a GGE with parameters that are changing kind of, I mean, that are relaxing on one over epsilon timescales. But then you have also corrections due to the finite coupling to the environment. So you're not, I mean, that is kind of taking into account that you're not fully integrable.
I see. So is there a way to understand why those conserved quantities are robust against this integrability breaking driving?
Yeah, so we coined this a greenhouse principle, because what's greenhouse? The point of the greenhouse is that the energy within the greenhouse is approximately conserved, because sun, like, and then even when you, so when you add sun and losses through the windows, your system is still approximately described by a thermal state with a temperature that is determined by the ratio of how much you drive versus how much you cool. But the energy is just approximately conserved. And then when you have an integrable system, a nearly integrable system in the presence of drive and losses, it's just sort of, yeah, the same in the sense that you have more of approximate conservation loss, but still you're, and now you need more temperatures, more parameters to describe such a state, but it's still, it's still, they are there because they're as important as an approximate conservation law as energy. You know, you get what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's kind of, it's very, I know that's a physical explanation. And I mean, maybe that's a good point where I can touch that we've done the same tricks also for MBL systems, because so what's an MBL system? It's also in the, okay, if the disorder is weak, it's so it's an MBL system is a system with interactions and disorder. And when the disorder is strong enough, it becomes emergently integrable. And then we've shown that even in the presence of coupling to the bus and to the drive, the steady state that you will stabilize in this way will be kind of approximately keeps on the ergodic side and a sort of a GG on the MBL side. So it will be kind of distinctly different, despite the fact that you've kind of ruined MBL in a strict sense. And then we said that, okay, if you can define a sort of an order parameter, and that's the variation of temperatures, which will be of course zero. I mean, if I could forget somehow, there are corrections again, because of finite coupling to the environment. But if I could take them to zero, this order parameter would be zero on the ergodic side, and then maybe jump or just grow and be of order one on the MBL side. And you can utilize this coupling, this approximate conservation loss, like in the integrable system, also for to study MBL in an open driven environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Can I please ask a question?
Sure.
Hi. Near the end of your talk, you mentioned when epsilon is order one, state did not look thermal. I was slightly confused. Here, your H is integrable or non-integrable?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. With a non-integrable to make it simpler, yeah.
Right. So then what is that final state? If I look at the density matrix, it still has to, H has to be still somehow sum of local operators to satisfy, to satisfy cluster decomposition or anything like that. If I just write on log of rho as a operator, what does it look like?
Okay, the thing is that, you, of course, I mean, if you have one row, then, I mean, if you take ln of it, it's okay. You can define something like an open, like an h for, and if you would just parameterize it like this. But the point is that here we are looking, so the twist is that actually we are not doing, so always to do this training and of the network, we need many realizations. So we have here many realizations that are coming from rotated single site and two site limblets with, and each realization is a different rotation. So we, so so there is not one single row. We are somehow asking whether now for this ensemble of data sets, is there some common feature that would characterize all of them? So like if you, before, if we took many different thermal expectation values at different temperatures, but for the same Hamiltonian, this is, this temperature is still a common feature. So for different data sets, it's just different, but it's associated with the same Hamiltonian. But here, when we have this Hamiltonian that's strongly coupled to baths, there is apparently not one single feature that would describe all of these data sets obtained from different, slightly different or different couplings to the environment.
But if I don't think in terms of machine learning and I just solve the problem, then there is some row you get at the end. And that row is some,
right. Yeah.
Most likely it is, it'll be surprising if it has some very non-local correlation, so that H is very, at least I would have naively thought that log of rho is still some sum of some operators, which are somehow sum of local operators and so on, so that the correlation functions still decay.
Yeah.
Exponentially, yeah. Or something like that.
I see your point, yeah.
But yeah, maybe it's unrelated to what you're doing. I'm sorry for maybe asking questions which are not obviously related to your machine learning scheme.
I see your point. But again, if you would do, if you would do some other standard, like fluctuation dissipation type of tests for your, for your observables calculated with respect to this row, I think they would not obey the usual relations that are there for thermal expectation values.
I see.
Or not? I have.
It's not obvious, but at least they should obey cluster decomposition. That's a much weaker requirement. That is, two-point correlation functions should follow.
That could be the case. Yeah, this Hamiltonian is kind of not too crazy. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think let me think about it myself. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. But I see your point. Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, can I ask one more question? This may be a much more broader question. So as you mentioned, there is a much more like an older way of thinking about this, this complexity barrier using the, say, operator state entanglement. And now you have a different way of thinking. Is there an analytical way to see that your way of thinking is somehow related to operator state entanglement? How does it relate these two? Is there some calculation, some analytical framework you can put this way of thinking so that it relates to more older way of thinking?
We've not attempted this. I don't know. I mean, in a sense, if you take all expectation values up to all operators up to a given support, this is like having a reduced density matrix of given support. So it might be interesting to relate the two or to see if one is, and if they, I mean, I would naively expect that they're not really one-to-one relate. I mean, that they're not, what's the relation? Or if, but we've not done anything analytically. But of course, it would be nice to place this measure into the older. Frames.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
Maybe a quick question if I can.
Sure.
So I had the impression that when you mentioned the MBL results there, that you could learn the Elbit Hamiltonian. Is that true? And could you discuss like the machine learning approach there? Is that a VAE you're interpreting also there?
So yeah, we've not done, so we've kind of asked the Griner's group if they would give us their data to analyze it, because they've done, so in this paper here, they've essentially considered the snapshots from the experiment of their group, and then either used really supervised learning or the confusion learn. So the supervised, where you compare it somehow with ED and give it labels of thermal, non-thermal, or with confusion learning to try to determine the phase transition point. And of course, like, we would like to just try it out. First of all, I mean, to detect the departure from the thermal data. I mean, of course, the one thing is that, what's the problematic part of MBL is in experiments is that there is this really slow relaxation to a truly thermal or truly non-thermal steady state. So even if we do this, I expect that the results will be quite broad, just because the experiment has not run or has not truly equilibrated to the really, ergodic thermal state. And then the second step could be that, maybe one could try to learn the Elbits through two with some sort of reconstruction from this.
Okay, but have you tried learning Elbits on some synthetic data, from
not yet.
Thank you.
Yeah. Team, so should we close it here? I just wanted to give two more slides advertisement for the other kind of open MBL stuff, but we can also.
Yeah, sure. That sounds good. I think if you briefly summarize these things, that'd be nice.
Yeah, or just tell what's the remaining puzzle there, because as I said, it's kind of very related to what I was already saying, and that's that also when you have an MBL system then coupled to the, or disordered system coupled to the paths and drive, the steady states are very different. And if I could really take these paths to be, infinitesimally small, this quantity, so variation in local temperatures would really show a phase transition. And that is would be zero on the ergodic side and then of order one on the MBL side. But what we put kind of a lot of, but that is still, it's numerically even challenging to have this epsilon to zero limit. And then we lifted the constraint and allowed for kind of finite coupling to the environment. And it's kind of, I mean, we realize that one again comes back to this annoying subdiffusion that I already mentioned, that kind of prevents the quantum simulators to really simulate well the MBL. So one does, okay, I consider a Hamiltonian system coupled to bus, I calculate a steady state. And what I see then, when I look at this variation of temperatures, that indeed, if I could take this coupling to bus to be zero, I would get zero variation on the ergodic side and a finite variation on the MBL side. But the problem is that when I have finite coupling to the environment, we see a non-analytic behavior that contains the dynamical exponent. So where epsilon is this coupling strength to the environment, which tells us that the way how this variation in temperatures grows as a function of epsilon is like, yeah, it changes more and more rapidly with epsilon. So on one side, it's nice because on the MBL side, this is some analytic dependence on the coupling strength to the environment, while on the ergodic side is non-analytic, and this allows us to put some lower bounds on the critical disorder and also to essentially fit and get the dynamical exponent as a function of disorder in really almost thermodynamic way. But the limitation is that at least we don't know, I mean, that we are somehow restricted to finite epsilons the way we do numerics. And it comes back to that even in such an open system where you've maybe thought that maybe you could go around subdiffusion and these long thermization times, it turns out that you can go around level spacing. So you get essentially thermodynamic results, but you still cannot go around these long relaxation times. And you would, in this case, you need to push this coupling strength to the environment towards zero. To be able to do more. I mean, otherwise you always just put lower bounds on the transition. And that's kind of, is another way to bridge the two stories, is another way how one could use now complexity to detect the MBL transition, because the complexity of density steady states in the two regimes are different, but it comes out with its own advantages, but still with some challenges which remain to be resolved even in this alternative approach to MBL. And here I will stop.
Yeah, thanks, Zala. It was a very interesting talk. Yeah, maybe we just have time for a couple more questions if there are any. Yeah, I guess we had quite a bit already. So, okay, yeah, let's just... thanks all again, and thanks for coming too.
Yeah, thanks.